For millions of people, this music can evoke feelings of excitement, anxiety, and dread. The HBO show Game of Thrones has enjoyed 5 seasons of critical and popular acclaim, taking us all over the fantastical worlds of Westeros and Essos. But the most recent episode had one Missouri senator tweeting that she was done with the show. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we're going to sit down with a critic, an English professor, and a political scientist to explore how this show is changing what we expect from television and storytelling. Stay with us. It's coming up right after this news.
You swore to find the Stark girls.
I found Arya. She didn't want my protection.
Sansa's still nice.
Will you shut your mouth? I didn't ask for your advice. I don't want anyone following me. I'm not a leader. All I ever wanted was to fight for a lord I believed in. The good lords are dead and the rest of them monsters.
The good lords are dead and the rest of them are monsters. This is the world we find ourselves in season 5 of HBO's Game of Thrones. Good morning. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, in for Gina Kaufman, and it's screen time. It's Friday and it's screen time. Our regular look at media that has people talking and joining me to explore what it is we love, hate, and makes us think about the show Game of Thrones are Loey Lockerbie. She's a critic for the Kansas City Star. Good morning, Loey.
Good morning.
And we also have Misty Schuberly. She's an associate professor of English at KU. Good morning, Misty.
Good morning.
And then we also have joining us Jack Riley. He's an assistant professor of political science at the New College in Florida. Good morning, Jack. Can you hear me, Jack? He should be joining us by the beautiful world of digital connection. We'll come back to Jack in a minute, but the most important thing to remind everybody about these screen time shows is that this conversation will be full of spoilers. Additionally, if you watch the show, you may know it has very adult themes, so I can't emphasize this enough. Use your discretion if adult themes are something you or your children just cannot handle. Totally understandable. But seriously, this stuff, spoilers, adult content, it's all coming up, and it's all coming up just around the corner. Here be dragons. So now's your opportunity to get out. And we'll remind you throughout the show, but, you know, this, consider yourself warned. So here we go. So I want to start with each of you. Loey, can you let me, you know, tell me what it is that got you interested in the show in the first place?
Well, a lot of it was just hearing people talk about it when it first started. And about how dramatic it was and how epic it was and what great characters it had. So I grabbed the DVDs of the first season and loved it so much I started reading the books and ripped through the books pretty quickly, which is amazing considering how huge those
books are. They're tomes.
Enormous. They're enormous. And I've been watching the show ever since. And it's great drama. It does have great characters. I'm, you know, enough of a geek that anything with fantasy elements is going to get my attention anyway. Mm-hmm.
So was it a friend that suggested it to you? Or
you know, when I was working at a public library and we had the DVDs and people were talking about it. And I thought, okay, well, I'll take a look at this. And it reminds me, there was another HBO show called Rome that I loved. And it reminds me probably more of that than anything else. So it's been a lot of fun.
And Misty, how about you?
Well, I've had some friends who have been book readers for a while. And so when I heard that the HBO show was coming, I was excited to have the opportunity to have a look at this world. I also knew that it drew heavily on fantasy and some medieval literature and history. Mm-hmm. And so as a professor who teaches medieval literature, I was ready and excited to see this latest pop culture version in order to feed that into the classroom and understand what assumptions my students might be coming to my courses with.
And did you find that they do come in with these assumptions based from the show? Like the show informs what they think they're going to experience in your class?
Yes, sometimes. Absolutely.
And let's try to talk with Jack Riley, assistant professor of political science at the New College. Doesn't sound like he's hey Jack, can you hear me?
Hey, yeah, I can hear you now.
Oh, great. So sorry about that. Glad to have you with us. Jack, what got you into Game of Thrones? How did you discover it?
I started reading the books back when I was in college, actually.
Oh, wow. So you've been with it from the beginning.
Yeah, well, not quite the beginning, but pretty close to the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I was very excited when it became an actual show, because I like the show as well.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that it becomes a topic of conversation around the water cooler in the political science department where you teach and or in your class?
My students certainly like it. And they I actually assigned something last week for them. That was just illustrating topics in political science via Game of Thrones. So I asked them to comment on how Game of Thrones, if they knew about it, was shown in political science.
Mm-hmm. Great, great. Well, I kind of want to jump right into it. And as I mentioned before, this is where the adult themes and the spoilers come up, because we're going to dive into probably the thing that the most people are talking about, which is the most recent episode of Game of Thrones here in season 5. And so if you've been following it from the beginning, Sansa Stark is in this most recent episode at the very closing scene. She's raped on her wedding night by her betrothed, Ramsay Bolton, a man we already know to be a twisted beyond imagination person. But this closing scene of the episode had many people talking, including Senator Claire McCaskill from Missouri, who tweeted, quote, "Okay, I'm done with Game of Thrones. Water garden, comma, stupid. Gratuitous rape scene, disgusting and unacceptable. It was a rocky ride that just ended." To dive right in, Loie, when you saw this scene, what did you feel? Or what did you tweet?
Well, I'm terrible at Twitter, so I didn't tweet anything. I was a little bit late watching the episode, so I'd heard people going on about it. And all I'm thinking is, oh, my God, what happened to Sansa? You know, and I know that this segment is not, it's different from what it is in the book. So I didn't have that to go with. And when I saw it, I realized, you know, why is this the breaking point? Mm-hmm. We've seen just as bad and worse. You know, we've seen what Ramsay Bolton did to Theon Greyjoy, which was pretty horrific.
A genital mutilation, yeah. Torture, psychological and physical.
Unfortunately, this is a very grim world, and this is the kind of thing that happens. And even though this wasn't in the books, it's certainly in keeping with the world of the books, and certainly with Ramsay Bolton's character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's just a lot of pop culture conversations going on right now about gender roles and rape culture. Yeah. And, you know, we had Mad Max coming out and all this complaining about the Avengers movie and, you know, and Mad Men ended the same night that this episode aired. And that's created a lot of discussion. So I think it may have pushed people to the limit there. But as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, yes, this is horrible, but this is Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. Have you seen this show? You know?
Yeah. What did you expect, Misty?
Well, I can understand how people would feel really uncomfortable with the horrifying way that Sansa is starting to perhaps develop some agency and is on a path to potentially reclaiming her home, making this moment where she's brought low in a horrible, horrible way all the more frustrating for people. Mm. But I can also understand, as a scholar, that this is another aspect of the really dark, complex world in Game of Thrones where the good people don't win.
Mm-hmm. Or if they win, it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
She hasn't entirely lost her agency, but it's just...
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. For me, I think that's the important question, is what happens next?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was, for me, that was kind of the point at which... That's kind of where I landed. And I thought, like, as a writing implement, you know, we had just seen her saying, "This is my home, and I am not scared of you or anybody." And in the back of my head, I was thinking, you have no idea who you're about to marry. I mean, we've seen, like, you know, probably the most disgusting human, you know, imaginable is your husband to be. Jack, anything to add here?
Yeah, my reactions were very similar to the rest of the panels. I find Ramsay's entire story in the show to be kind of cringeworthy. Anytime he comes on screen, something terrible happens to somebody. And so I also am not quite sure why this particular one would be the breaking point, although this was just as painful to watch as many of the ones that have happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I was talking, but I was talking with my brother about this because he like immediately texted me like right after that scene happened, and it was like, did you just see this? And he was saying, you know, for him, it was an example of the girl in the refrigerator problem. Do you guys know about this? It's apparently something from comic books where something bad happens to a female character purely to give a male character or a love interest like motivation.
Yeah, it happens in a lot of action movies and thrillers. And yeah, things like that. I hate that trope, but yeah, I know what he's talking about. But this is so not bad.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it is, because I don't think that there's a care. You know, there is Brianna Tarth, who's waiting off in the wings, you know, potentially to rescue
and
her.
And a woman.
Yeah, and a woman, and that helps things. But
yeah, I don't see that as something that Martin uses or the producers use. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated than that. I mean, it's a lazy trope, and there's nothing lazy about this show. But mm-hmm. I do think that in the overall picture, the terrible characters generally get their comeuppance. And even though the good characters suffer a lot, the smart ones, the ones who figure out how to play the game, mm-hmm. usually, you know, they make it. So mm-hmm. I'm with Misty. I want to see what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, that's the important question, because what happens next tells us whether or not the showrunners are having it as gratuitous sexual violence, or whether there will be some turnaround in which Sansa gets justice, or maybe in this world, revenge for what's happened. You know, and I just don't want to feel like the show depicts this violence, especially this awful sexual violence, and then ignores it as if it's somehow acceptable in either fantasy or reality.
I want to open up the phone lines to folks who may want to add to this. So you're listening to Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Milton in for Gina Kaufman. We're talking about Game of Thrones, and we're focusing mostly on season 5 here, Game of Thrones. But again, spoiler alert, in order to talk about this, we'll have to reveal things about the show throughout. And also, you know, be mindful. This is a pretty adult show, so if that be something you're sensitive to, this would be another point to turn out. But if you do want to join our conversation, you can call 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888. And Misty, I kind of was interested in, you know, you study all this medieval literature, mm-hmm. and, you know, I suspect like issues of sexual assault weren't even coming up in medieval literature, or am I off on that assumption?
Well, it does come up on occasion.
Is it like coded in the way it's written, or is it actually like more blunt than we would think it is?
There are some more blunt things. There's Chaucer's Wife of Bath's Tale, in which the very beginning of the story is a knight raping a young woman he comes across in a field. And it's not explicit. It just says he took from her maidenhead, her virginity. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of issues definitely come up in this literature. There are some French tales called fabliaux that depict all kinds of sexual activities and even perversions. Mm-hmm. So some of these things do come up in medieval literature. It's not all about purity and chastity and the romanticized notion of chivalry that we get from Victorian novels or even mm-hmm. Tolkien.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that occurred to me about this scene in particular, and I was trying to figure out like why people are potentially so reactive to this, is there have been two other sexual assaults in the show that I could recall. There was Daenerys on her marriage mm-hmm. night, and then there was also Lannister, the Lannister's brother and sister, over the corpse of their child. But the thing that struck me about this scene was that Theon is like instructed to watch. Theon, this character who, you know, he's had a very long, twisted tale of, you know, being a part of this Stark family household, being cast away or leaving that household, coming back, trying to take it over, and then getting abducted and tortured and mutilated. And now he finds himself back in this house, but as a, you know, a servant of the twisted Bolton. And but in this scene, he's told to watch. And in this scene, in this time, the viewer is moved to the perspective of him. Like the reaction shot is of him weeping, you know, forcing to watch this. And it made me think of some other scenes where like it's it seems that the emotional impact of something really gets brought up when a when we see a character reacting to it, not just as a voyeur. Does that resonate with you a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, for most of that bit, the focus is on Sansa, and then it pans over to Theon, and that's where it ends. I mean, I think the show is not necessarily that graphic in what it portrays, but it does, well, in this scene particularly,
right.
It's all, we hear what's happening mm-hmm. more than we see. The character's reactions, and that's what you're really focusing on. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting that the other rape scenes are also in these unusual contexts that don't turn out the way you expect them to later.
right, Misty.
So
I agree with what you said about we feel and experience it through Theon, but I think the fear that some people have is that the story is going to shift now and it's going to be about him and how he reacts after the fact, he become some kind of savior figure or something like that. And so I think that's one of the concerns that I've heard that people have about this turn in the storyline.
Interesting. I have a hard time imagining them going that direction, but yeah.
Right.
That's kind of how I saw it, though, too. Sorry, did I interrupt?
No, please, go on, Josh.
That's kind of how I saw it, too, with a focus on Theon. I wondered if they were trying to use this as a way of motivating something he's going to do in the future, because there was such a focus on his reaction to the rape itself. And I didn't, that was partially possibly the most uncomfortable part of it, I thought, was that was, as we were talking about just a little bit earlier, the focus of the scene was almost on how this rape affected a male character who was off screen. Well, not entirely off screen, but directly to the part.
Mm-hmm.
I can see it having an impact because we've kind of been waiting for his breaking point.
Well, that was my biggest hope was that he will redeem himself. He'll shut the door and murder the Bolton, that this would be the thing that has him crack back towards good. But nope.
Yeah,
nope.
I wouldn't place any bets on that. Or even if he tries, I wouldn't place any bets on him succeeding because we've seen how broken he is. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be interesting.
Well, before we shift gears just slightly, I want to get a perspective of Josh from Topeka. Josh, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well.
Oh, good, good. Hey, I was listening to your show, and I heard the other day that a senator, this was the breaking point for a senator, and I just really don't, I don't understand that really. Why is this the breaking point? Mm-hmm. We've seen pregnant mothers get stabbed in the belly at Red Wedding, and one of the quotes from the books is that there is no wedding without a bedding. I understand mm-hmm. that the scene was bad and probably hard for people to watch, but maybe this is a dissensitive of me to say, but I guess Sansa had to know that this was going to happen if she was going through with this wedding, with this plan, that the marriage has to be consummated.
Mm. I would push back for a second. There's a difference between consent, married or not, and non-consent in this case.
Not so much
well,
in this
that,
world.
That's true. I mean, it doesn't change the fact that she wanted it to happen, mm-hmm. but had to know that it was going to happen. That TV viewers had to know that this was going to happen. If she gets married, they're going to sleep together. Mm. I mean, not everyone's Tyrion. Not everyone is going to just be the gentleman. Mm. And not that Tyrion's a gentleman, but when he was forced to marry her, he was. He didn't do what he was supposed to do.
Yeah, particularly the young Lord Bolton. Yeah.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, so for you, it hasn't changed your experience of the show.
I read the books, too, and personally, I feel like this scene was quite toned down from what happens in the books.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Yeah. Josh, thanks so much for your call. So I kind of want to shift gears just slightly, and, I'm sure these issues will come up again, but take a step back and look at women more broadly in the show, because to me that's kind of what has made this so controversial in some ways, is just they do so many interesting things with female characters here, and Loie, I'm wondering if there are one or two that stand out for you.
Well, Cersei has always fascinated me, book and show, because she is, you know, she's so angry and so frustrated because she knows she's at least as smart as all the men around her, if not smarter. And she knows how to play this game, but she's constantly kept in a box because of her gender.
Can you, just the briefest, I know, right?
Well, I mean, she's a member of this very, very powerful family, and she was married off to the king.
Yeah, she was queen.
And yeah, she was queen, and now, well, one of her sons was king for about 5 minutes and was killed, and now her other son is king, and she's the queen mother. She's, you know, trying to manipulate things, but she's constantly, you know, being forced into situations where her father tried to marry her off to a gay guy because it was a political alliance. And she, you know, at this point in the story, she is starting to think that she has a whole lot more power than she probably does.
Mm-hmm.
And she's basically allied herself with the theocratic movement that, you know, you can already see where it could come back to bite her. But it's really interesting to see how, you know, how frustrated she is and how that affects her behavior. And there was one scene where her father was arguing with her about something. And he says, you know, this isn't because you're a woman. It's because you're not as smart as you think you are. Which could be the motto of the whole show. You know, nobody's as smart as they think they are.
Yeah, yeah. Misty, your feelings on Cersei?
Yeah, I'm thinking about her and thinking about a lot of the other marriages that we've seen, and it seems like we don't have any happy ones. Maybe Ned and Catelyn Stark, there may be potential with Marcella and the Prince of Dorne, but it seems as though this is where women are traded.
Right.
You know, and used in sort of an economic and political decision rather than, as Cersei, respected for any intelligence they might have or treated properly, as in the case with Sansa, for instance. And it seems like some of the more interesting characters for me are Brienne of Tarth, who holds her own against men in battle. And there are some mild medieval precedents for a figure like
this.
I mean, well, sort of like Joan of Arc. I mean, she's the closest you can get, but she wasn't, you know, a big fighting woman. She was out on the battlefield with men and a leader and had armor, but, you know, she wasn't the kind of warrior that we see in Brienne. And I have hope for her, for Brienne, and for Arya Stark and where her storyline is going, that in some ways these strong women characters might help balance the women that we've seen represented as victims or the women we've seen disrespected.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jack, I'm curious because, like, the thing that I find most compelling is even though these women don't have necessary, like, power and title, they seem to use other forms of power and manipulation to get what they need.
Yeah, that's true. And I think the other woman on the show who's really interesting in this regard is Daenerys over and Essos with her dragons, because we see her kind of move from being this incredibly powerless figure to, at this point, ruling over cities with armies. And the path for her between figuring out how to rule and how to effectively wield power is very interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. And you know, about Daenerys, there's actually a clip I want to play with her, because one of the things I find that is so kind of compelling with her as a character is how she seems to be one of the few characters who has principle, but then also does a lot of learning from her mistakes. Mm-hmm. And so what I want to play for us now is the clip of her talking with, and I may mispronounce his name, Hizadar Zal Lorak, who is a slave-owning noble in this city that she's recently taken over. And she's freed all the slaves, and he's coming to her to petition her for something.
Queen Daenerys, tales of your beauty were not exaggerated.
I thank you.
Mine is one of the oldest and proudest families in Meereen.
Then it is my honor to receive you.
My father, one of Meereen's most respected and beloved citizens, oversaw the restoration and maintenance of its greatest landmarks, this pyramid included.
For that, he has my gratitude. I should be honored to meet him.
You have, Your Grace. You crucified him. I pray you'll never live to see a member of your family treated so cruelly.
Your father crucified innocent children.
My father spoke out against crucifying those children. He decried it as a criminal act, but was overruled. Is it justice to answer one crime with another?
I am sorry you no longer have a father, but my treatment of the masters was no crime. You'd be wise to remember that.
What's done is done. You are the queen, and I am a servant of Meereen, a servant who does not wish to see its traditions eradicated.
And what traditions do you speak of?
The tradition of funeral rite, proper burial in the Temple of the Graces. My father and 162 noble Meereenese are still nailed to those posts, carrion for vultures, rotting in the sun. Your Grace, I ask that you order these men taken down so that they might receive proper burials.
And what of the slave children these noble Meereenese crucified? They were rotting in the sun as well. Would you have begged me for their right to a proper burial?
Your Grace, I cannot defend the actions of the masters. I can only speak to you as a son who loved his father. Let me take his body down. Let me have him brought to the temple and buried with dignity so that he might find peace in the next world.
Bury your father, Star Zolora.
Yeah, so what I love about this scene is, like, we love Daenerys because we, like, have this perception that she's coming in to rescue all these people. She's like, you know, has all this triumph. And in this one scene, you know, she's like, oh, everyone loves me. And he's like, yes, you met him and you crucified my father.
Killed an innocent man, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And nobody's hands are clean. And I'm curious your response when you saw this scene, Loey.
Well, and again, I had read the books at this point. Mm. So I knew that, you know, yeah, she started out as a pawn, as a victim. And gradually, over the course of living with the Dothraki and then leading her army, she's become very powerful, but she's still very young.
And naive,
yeah,
too.
And very naive, very idealistic. And again, you know, the good characters who survive are the ones who learn how to play this game. And she's very slowly beginning to learn. But, you know, there's a lot of room for error because she's coming into a culture she doesn't really know anything about. And she's having to learn a lot, and it's starting to spin out of her control, and it never really was in her control.
Well, I want to take a quick break here, and we'll continue our conversation about Game of Thrones, and we'll be shifting slightly to a little bit more of the political world, getting into the science of that and how it all kind of comes together and falls apart. You can call in during the break. What's been the most political or social move that's kind of amazed or confounded you? The number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We'll be right back in Two Shakes of a Lamb's Tail. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton in for Gina Kaufman, and it's Screen Time today. And we're exploring the show Game of Thrones. And I'm joined by Loey Lockerbie, a critic for the Kansas City Star. Morning again, Loey.
Good morning.
And Missy Schieberle, associate professor of English at KU. Morning.
Hi there.
And Jack Riley, who joins us from New College of Florida, where he teaches political science. Morning, Jack.
Morning.
And again, just a spoiler warning. This show, we're entering it, assuming you have at least some knowledge of Game of Thrones, that you've been watching perhaps all the episodes. But, you know, in order to have a good conversation about this, we want to, you know, we will be covering things that you may or may not have been exposed to. So if you haven't caught up, warning there. Also, there are some adult themes that may come up in the course of this conversation. If that be something you're not into, now's the time to find something else to do. But let's just shift gears a little slightly and kind of build off what we were just talking about with Daenerys in terms of, like, the politics and the growing of many characters in here and learning how to play the Game of Thrones in this case. And so, Jack, I'm curious, in that clip we heard just before the break, and we have this moment where she comes in and she frees all the slaves, but there are all these political repercussions from that action. And, you know, as you watched it, what were you thinking about?
As I watched it, I thought it was interesting because it is another example of the show kind of playing with our expectations a little bit. So we kind of automatically would think, oh, we have this very good character coming in and, you know, killing all the slave masters and everyone's going to love her. And then it turns out that when she starts ruling the city, she still has to implement herself into the existing power structure in some way. And it turns out the people that she just killed were the existing power structure. And they're not very happy about many of their family leaders being off, so to speak. And I think it kind of illustrates what we were talking about earlier, again, how characters on the show only survive based on how well they figure out how to build coalitions of support among people with power under them, which is very interesting.
It reminds me of like a number of moments from just history in general. I remember reading that one of the criticisms of the Iran Revolution and the United States' involvement is that like all the middle class like left Iran, a lot of the educated elite, so the only power structure that was left was this perceived fanatical base, and so they were the ones that came to power and produced some of the things that we see playing out in Iran today, and it also makes me think of Reconstruction and the end of slavery.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a lot of parallels here to other instances in history where we have one power coming in from the outside and just deciding they're going to rule. And then the reality of just deciding you're going to rule is often a lot messier than you think it's going to be.
And was it logically consistent in the way that you study and think about political science? Did it seem like it worked for you both as a as a consumer of the media, but also as an academic?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's exciting to see something where the White Knight, or in this case, like the Daenerys, the Khaleesi, if you want to call her that. Comes in and doesn't just like find everyone adoring her afterwards, because that's not really how the world that we know works. And I think one of the things about the show and about the series that's really interesting is that it doesn't simplify things too much. One of the things that's compelling about it is that it does feel real in some fashion. I mean, as real as a show with dragons can feel.
Yeah, exactly. Misty, did you add something else?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think it's part of the way that Martin is moving away from a fantasy genre.
Martin being the writer of the original book.
And the showrunners following and keeping with his vision are trying to break down the kind of binaries that usually structure most fantasy novels, where there's clear-cut good and clear-cut evil. And in this case, he's really trying to dig into the gray areas and the really messy, complicated things. And I don't think that either the showrunners or Martin really shy away from representing things that we know are morally wrong or even repugnant, you know, whether it's gender issues or racism or classism. And it's really his willingness and the showrunner's willingness to deal with these issues that get modern people's interests, I think. And that's one of the reasons why viewers are attracted to it. Mm-hmm. It's because we're still dealing with a lot of these issues in our society.
Yeah. Yeah. Loie?
Well, now I was just thinking about the larger picture of the politics and the power struggles and how, you know, in a democratic society, it's very different, but you still get these, you know, people moving behind the scenes and people, you know, anytime there's power involved, you're going to have these, you know, people like Cersei manipulating things from the background.
Yeah.
Or people like, Robert Baratheon being this big hero and then turning into a slob who can't do anything except drink and mess around with women. It's the price of power and how it's used and who can manipulate it. And here it's much more a sort of medieval structure where you have absolute power and you have lords and kings fighting over territory and who's going to rule what. And, you know, we're about to see some more power plays going on with the Baratheons and the Starks and the Boltons.
Yeah, Misty, go on.
Well, and that is part of the fact that Martin's basing a lot of his novels and these conflicts on the historical Wars of the Roses from 15th century England, where we had one faction ruling and then a powerful nobleman and another faction battling them for power and winning. But then there was a falling out in that winning faction, the Yorkist faction, and the major advisor to the king disagreed with him on a number of things and said, you know what, I'm changing sides and taking all of my armies and fighting for the other side now. So there's a lot of this kind of back and forth and factions and moving behind the scenes that's drawing directly on some historical material.
Yeah, and the fact that, like, power, it's so weird because everybody's questing after this throne. It seems like that seems to be like kind of the implication, but one of the things I like about the show is that some people aren't questing the throne, they're questing revenge, there are lots of things that they are after, but that they're all going after this thing, and it tantalizes them with the potential for power, but anybody who gets there, they end up dead, but they end up schemed against. Like, it seems like it would be the worst job you want. And it makes you think of season one where Ned Stark was like, I'm really not looking forward to becoming, you know, this powerful hand of the king. This seems like the worst possible thing that could happen to me and my family.
He botches it spectacularly. He's a good person,
yeah,
but very, very naive.
Yeah.
And that's what sinks him.
Yeah. Jack, I want to turn to you here. What are some of the characters that you've turned to that have interested you the most, kind of from this political maneuvering side of things?
And the first one that interested me was, I think in the first book or the first season, the character that we're all drawn to immediately is Ned, because he seems to be the one who's doing things right and is principled and all this sort of stuff. And then, as we've mentioned, he ends up screwing it up terribly because he's not willing to play the game the way it needs to be played in order to be successful. The first book in many ways was shocking for that reason, and it was the first example, and it was kind of Martin as the writer really saying, no, if you're playing this Game of Thrones, so to speak, you have to play to win, mm-hmm. because playing in any other way just won't work for you, you know?
And you know, one of the characters that has stood out to me this entire show has been Littlefinger, Peter Baelish. Mm-hmm. He's just this pure Machiavellian, and you never know what he's after. It always is amazing to me how selfish a person he can be. I'm curious, Jack, if there were things about him that really spoke to you as well.
I mean, he's almost the perfect example in the show of perfect self-interested, rational actor, the perfect Machiavellian power player, he has.
Right. He's a libertarian no dream.
I'm not sure he's anyone's dream.
Yeah. But I'm sorry, could you tell us a little bit about him and about his character, for those who may, not be totally up to speed? I know it's a big task, but, just a little bit.
Yeah. So he's this character from a minor house. Like, he didn't have much power, by right of his name or anything like that. Like, many of the characters we see have power just because they're from the Stark family or like the Lannister family or one of these families that's been around for ages and ages. And he got all his power because he was just very, very good at playing people with power off each other and getting rewarded for it. And where we are in the show right now, I mean, he is trying to, and very close to becoming, one of the most powerful people in the entire kingdom. Purely off his ability to play power politics effectively. And in many of the cases in the show, we see are examples of people not playing it well and dying. In his case, he's often in the background, but when we see him playing, he's playing it very well. And it's because he, at least in the show's world, has no compunctions and will just pursue whatever he wants in order to benefit himself.
Yeah, I struggle with him though, because sometimes I feel like nobody is that smart. Nobody can if I kill the king, that means that, Cersei will do this, which will require this, which will make this happen to this character, which, of course will mean this. And then, playing that many moves ahead. And I'm curious, is there anybody you've ever met in your entire studies of political science? It's like, yeah, this is feasible. This is possible. I've met someone who can, or discovered in the annals of history, who could do what Littlefinger does.
I mean, I agree with that criticism. I find the Littlefinger a little bit, and also Varys, the other character who's kind of in the background of the show, yeah. Playing power politics like that. I find both of them to be a little bit overskilled for what would be reasonable,
Yeah.
And I think that that's some of the benefit to writing fiction sometimes as opposed to looking at history. I'm sure there have been people in history that have been this way. I think the way that I interpret it that makes a little more sense to me, and in the books he's portrayed a little bit more as an opportunist. It's not that he necessarily has tons of like skills and ability to see like 8 moves ahead when everyone else is just playing like 1 move ahead, so much as he just creates chaos and then is really good at figuring out how to best appeal to people in this chaos. Like, he benefits when existing power structures have fallen because he has none himself. And that strikes me as a little bit more feasible. You can see some examples of this in the past, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right. Misty, you wanted to add something?
I wanted to add that I think it is, and agree, that one of Baelish's strengths is that he's so adaptable. And to offer one historical plausible analog in Cromwell, if any of our viewers, listeners are also watchers of Wolf Hall, we see Thomas Cromwell negotiating some very sticky moments with Henry VIII. Mm-hmm. And the historical figure did manage his way out of some problematic situations.
We have to take one more break, and there's still time to join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And when we return, we'll be exploring what this show is telling us about ourselves. Stay with us. And we're back at Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, in for Gina Kaufman. And today it is Screen Time, and we're exploring the HBO show Game of Thrones. I'm joined by Loie Lockerbie from the Kansas, critic for the Kansas City Star, Misty Sherbilly from KU. She teaches English there. And Jack Riley, associate professor, assistant professor of political science at the New College in Florida. Again, folks, spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about Game of Thrones. There's no way to talk about that without kind of building on some of the things from the past. And we're assuming everybody is up to date. So if you don't want to be part of learning those things, now's the time. Additionally, some adult themes may come up during the course of this conversation, so be aware of that. And I want to spend these closing minutes trying to figure out some of the major themes of this show and why how these major themes are kind of changing, I think, the way that we expect from television. And one of those themes, I want to bring one of our callers in to kind of address, Cal from Lawrence. Cal, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, thank you very much.
Yeah. What would you like to add?
I would just like to add that, well, first off, I was really impressed by the panel, and one of the reasons I kept listening to your show was the promise of spoiler alerts and the panel and what the professor would have to say about it. I personally have no interest in Game of Thrones whatsoever, largely due to who it's written by, and a lot of the things just don't sound fun. It's, to me, there are a lot of other kind of cool authors that could have their chance to have their shows made. My particular favorite, Ursula K. Le Guin, who wrote the Wizard of Earthsea trilogy, et cetera. I would rather read something like that or spend my time elsewhere than listening to these kind of things that go on in that necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I would also think it would be cool if someone were to take old actual tales from things and make it, because, you know, if people are going to mistake it for history, why not go ahead and make things that actually represent things that happen, and therefore we can learn from it too. Maybe, you know, the rape and stuff that happens in the show, it might, I think, might help to desensitize. Like, if we wanted to hear some of the stuff like that and be entertained with things that happen, we could just look at the news on what's happening in our colleges and stuff. It just seems like a waste. But
And you were mentioning written. I'm just trying to figure out, like, if there's something you're getting at here. You're mentioning, you know, written by people like that. Are you saying, like, white male authors, that there's just enough stories from that type of person, or are you?
Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. The author, I don't know. He's already privileged as being a male and white in our society, and now after writing and making up and dropping all this stuff out of his head, he's super rich now. I don't think he was before. I'm also not concerned about it, but like now, it just doesn't make sense to me necessarily. Also, maybe I'm a contrarian in that nerdy regard where everyone's talking about Game of Thrones, and that makes me want to be into it even less.
Well, you have maybe to know yourself. That's
sold out, man.
Yeah, very important.
I can admit it. And I just wanted to say too, it's really cool to hear the professor's ideas on things and stuff. That's part of the reason why I listened.
Thank you so much, Cal. Thanks for the input. And I'm curious, you know, you were mentioning earlier, Misty, that people come in to your class you know, bringing in all this baggage from Game of Thrones. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, my students often will ask me things about the incest, for instance, between the brother and sister, Cersei and Jaime Lannister. And I suppose there's sort of precedent for that in Arthurian legend when Arthur accidentally sleeps with his half-sister and father's Mordred.
Could happen to anybody.
But of course, there's a really negative outcome mm-hmm. from that. And I guess in terms of why we don't build things more on history is that, you know, Martin is taking things from the Middle Ages that span 1,000 years of history and collapsing them as if they happen at the same time. History, broadly speaking, could be rather boring. He's plucked out some of the most scandalous things or most interesting things and put them together and interwoven them in a complex and interesting way.
Lowy.
Well, and I think it also illustrates how genre storytelling can get at subjects and ideas that something more realistic can't. Mm-hmm. You can put dragons in it and it kind of distracts people from the fact that you're dealing with really serious issues that get people talking. Mm-hmm. And also I would point out that, you know, she was talking about Wolf Hall, that's just been adapted, and things like Fall of Giants, I think, is one of them. And there's, you know, there was Rome, there was
those?
The Tudors, the Borgias. I mean, there are a lot of these historical mm-hmm. dramas out there that are very popular too, mm-hmm. but you know, interesting issues are interesting issues, whether they're portrayed in historical drama or fantasy or whatever, mm-hmm. you know.
And Jack, curious, you know, we mentioned this a little bit earlier, but, you know, how has it bled into the work that you do?
Well, my students certainly enjoy it. And I view science fiction and fantasy and any sort of literature or popular culture as ways to kind of illustrate concepts in class. I find it useful for that. As for my students bringing it into class, my classes tend to be much more statistical or American history focused, so not quite as much, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn to Sean here. Sean's calling from Lawrence. Sean, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Yeah, what would you like to add to the conversation?
Well, first, again, great discussion, very interesting takes, and you know, with all respect to the previous caller, I'm a religious follower of Martin and the show, and so coming at it from a little bit of a different perspective, but I do have a question about race,
right.
Actually, and the presentation of race on the show. And, you know, you have these examples, these narratives, for instance, you know, Daenerys being this white savior, the Mesa chant from all those abject brown people, you know, the wildlings, which, you know, in many ways have this collective experience and this worldview that parallels Native Americans and Aboriginal peoples. They're all white. And you also have the storyline now emerging recently this last season with the Martells, which I think is also an opportunity in some ways to address some of these kind of racial dynamics, because they don't meet the traditional kind of white Westeros world that we've been kind of immersed in, for that aspect of the show. And I just kind of was curious what the panel's take was on the racial dynamics in the show and the presentation of race on the show.
Excellent question, Sean. Let's get into it. Loie.
Wow. You know, it's definitely that sort of European, where the main characters are all sort of white, English-speaking,
yes, transatlantic.
Yeah, and then you go to Dorne, and it's more Mediterranean, or you go to Meereen, and it's more Middle Eastern. The Dothraki are basically like Mongol hordes.
Yeah, I think that's what they call them, the
yeah,
horde.
I mean, essentially, yeah, that's kind of what it's based on. But, you know, I like the fact that they sort of position Daenerys as a white savior, but it doesn't quite turn out that way. You know, I think that Martin is aware of the complexities of different cultures and races clashing and not understanding each other, and how that can go south, the same way he's aware of gender roles and how that can go south.
Mm-hmm. Misty?
Yeah, I would say that I think that, again, this is one of those places where he's playing with binaries and showing us that when we have these East versus West or the white people versus the brown people conflicts, that it's always a little bit more complicated than just that. And through Dany's experiences in particular,
Dany being
Daenerys Targaryen, when she's married into the Dothraki horde, she eventually becomes one of them in a way and becomes their leader by embracing some of their traditions. And You know, so we see her having this Western white viewpoint, but adjusting and compromising and understanding and valuing some of the peoples from the other worlds she interacts with.
Mm-hmm. And we have just like, you know, a little under a minute here. So, Jack, I want to start with you. I mean, loaded question here, but what is your hope for the rest of season 5? / like, I can't see a good ending out of this story at all. Jack, we'll start with you.
I mean, I hope there's going to be a good ending. I think Martin's been interviewed and he said that the ending is going to be bittersweet. So, you know, hopefully we'll see something good. I'm just excited to see what happens.
And Loie?
I think Martin loves his characters, and, you know, I think he'll give them the endings they deserve.
And Misty?
I agree with that, and I have no clue where this is going, which is one of the things that keeps me watching.
Great. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Loie Lockerbie, critic for the Kansas City Star, thank you.
Thank you.
And Misty Schieberle, associate professor of English at Kansas University. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jack Riley, assistant professor of political science at the New College of Florida. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
This conversation will be posted on the web later this afternoon at kcur.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast feed in iTunes or your own podcasting service. And this also, George R.R. Martin is going to be in town this weekend at Conquest 46, a science fiction convention that's at the downtown Marriott this weekend. He's the guest of honor. You can follow Central Standard on Twitter. We're KCURCST. I'm MLM_industries. Our show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross with myself. Fridays are done by Jen Chen, and our announcer is Linda Scher. We'll be bringing you a special on Memorial Day, and we'll return on Tuesday with a conversation on bike infrastructure. Up to Date is next with Danny Alexander. Stay with us.